What a mess. Y'all need a maid service. Alabama looked under Nancy's bed, then checked the space beside her desk. She went to the closet next. I'm sorry, Julia said. Do I know you? I'm a friend of Nancy's. The girl opened up Nancy's closet. She said I could borrow her. There it is. She yanked out a leather satchel, displacing piles of shoes. When she turned around, her eyes took in Julia in a slow, head-to-toe takedown. Nice socks. She left, leaving a sour air of disapproval behind her. Julia looked down at her socks. They were gray with black and tan dachshunds stitched into the material. She wanted to run into the hall and ask the girl what was wrong with her socks. But she knew that the statement was not about the socks. It was about how the girl could put Julia in her place. Julia understood these games, but she was at a loss as to how to play them. She looked at her watch. Her Spencer class didn't start until noon. She still needed to drop off the yellow scarf for her sister. There were also some printouts that her mother had promised to leave on the kitchen table. The sun was shining, the weather was crisp. Maybe a bike ride would clear some of the demons from her head. Julia pulled on her jeans, threw on a sweater over her t-shirt, grabbed her purse, and loaded up her book bag. She had already locked the door when she realized she should have brushed her teeth and run a comb through her hair. But she could do that when she got home. To her parents' home, she meant, because the house on Boulevard wasn't technically where she lived anymore. Outside the dorm, she wrestled with the lock on her bike, grinding the key through a layer of rust. The morning mist had completely burned off by the time she rode her bicycle past the black iron arch that marked the entrance to the North Campus. She probably should have brought her jacket, but she was all right as long as she stayed in the sunshine. She weaved through the students milling around the center of Broad Street. Their mood seemed light. The weather was caught between winter and spring, and any day that promised sunshine was a day to be celebrated. The distance between Julia's dorm and the house was less than 15 minutes, but it always felt like the ride took longer going there than it did coming back. Turning the corner onto the tree-lined streets of her childhood always brought a sense of nostalgia. Julia rose up from her seat as she coasted down Boulevard. The stately Victorians and ranch houses were as familiar to her as the back of her hand. Mostly professors lived in the area, but her mother claimed some of the old-timers had been here since before Jesus lost his sandals. She nodded to Mrs. Carter, who still kept her garden hose handy in case a kid tried to cut through her wide front yard. She crossed to the opposite side of the street in anticipation of the Barton Zappy Springer Spaniel who, no matter how many times he practically choked himself, completely forgot he was chained to a tree every time a person went past. She turned into the driveway of her parents' yellow Victorian. Pepper's bike was leaned against the front porch, which didn't mean anything because Julia's middle sister was 16 years old and had plenty of friends who could drive her to school. Her baby sister's pink bike was gone, because perfect little Sweet Pea was always exactly where her mother and father expected her to be. Sweet Pea. Julia's youngest sister was neither sweet nor pea-shaped, more like a pointy stick. The nickname had come because she had refused to eat anything but sweet peas the summer she turned 8 years old. It was an adorable piece of family lore, like Pepper being called Pepper because Grandma said she had hell and pepper in her hair. But Julia was the one trapped all summer cranking open a can of peas every time the little brat bellowed for more. Not to mention what happened to the peas on their way out. You would have thought the stupid twerp would have disappeared into a puddle of green diarrhea, but no, she was still around. Julia felt guilty for that last thought. She should be kinder to her little sister. But it was hard, because she had it so much easier than Julia did. as if the 5-year age difference had worn her parents down from hard, unmovable boulders into tiny pebbles you could skip across the creek. Of course Julia loved Sweet Pea. They were sisters, after all. But sometimes, she wanted to strangle her. They were sisters, after all. To assuage the guilt, Julia reminded herself of the times that they all came together. Like on the rare instances that their parents really argued. Really argued, because they had heated discussions about a lot of things. And all three girls would sleep in the same bed, as if being together would protect them from the shouting. Or when Grandma told Pepper she needed to lose her baby fat and Sweet Pea called her a sour old biddy. Or when Julia got arrested the first time she ever tried to smoke pot and both of her sisters stood vigil outside her bedroom door until her parents had finished yelling at her. Or when they all sobbed like babies when Charles and Diana got married because it was so romantic how much they loved each other. And all the Carroll sisters hoped for in life was that their sisters would find the same kind of forever love, preferably with a wealthy prince. The memories made Julia feel nostalgic as she made her way up to the house. She skipped over the broken porch step, the one her mother yelled at her father to fix, and dodged the pot of dying crocuses, the ones her father yelled at her mother to replant. The front door was unlocked, as usual. No one was sure where a key was, and her mother was reasonably certain that any thief would see the tattered state of their living room furniture and decide there was nothing worth stealing. Julia's father was a vet. He was constantly bringing home strays, and when her mother put her foot down, Julia and her sisters would start bringing them home. It was not without mild disapproval that the Yellow Victorian was known around the neighborhood as the Dr. Doolittle house. As if on cue, a brown tabby of unknown ownership tangled itself into Julia's legs as she struggled to put down her book bag. There was a low woof from the couch where Mr. Peterson, a maimed terrier, was recuperating on his back. Ms. Crabapple, a golden lab with memory issues, was on the floor beside him. The gentle ruminations of a convalescing toucan came from the sunroom. Girls, I want you to meet Signora Pinch Your Fingers from the family Remphastidae, her father had told them, introducing the bird with the usual formality he reserved for patients. Ay caramba, her mother had mumbled, then disappeared into the basement for the rest of the night. Julia gave the dogs a pet before heading into the kitchen, which was its usual mess. Breakfast plates and dishes were waiting for her sisters to get home from school and wash them. Sweet Pea would do it so slowly that finally Pepper would take over. An unfamiliar orange cat jumped onto the counter, a clear violation of her mother's only rule for cats. Julia picked him up and placed him on the floor. The cat jumped back up, but she'd figured she'd done her part. She spotted the stack of printouts on the kitchen table. She had asked her mother to find any articles about missing girls in the state of Georgia over the most recent 12 months. The handwriting at the top of the first page was as precise as a kindergarten teacher's, which meant her mother had gotten one of the junior librarians to run the microfiche machine. The woman had written a note. These are the articles that had no follow-up story. Re, a return. Julia layered some peanut butter onto a banana as she read the first printout. 2 months ago, the Clayton News Daily had run a front-page story about a girl who had gone missing from the junior college campus. The photograph had printed too dark to get any idea of what the girl looked like, but the description said she was brunette and pretty. Julia turned the page. The Statesboro Herald. Another missing girl, this one last seen at a movie theater. Described as athletic and attractive. The next article was from the News Observer. A missing girl last seen near the Fannin County Fairgrounds. Tall, with long dark hair and striking features. The Tri-County News. Eden Valley girl reported missing. Blonde hair, blue eyes, former beauty queen. The Telegraph. Headline, Mercer student's roommate. She never came home. The student's pastor was quoted in the story. She is a beautiful, godly young woman, and we all just want her back. Pretty, striking, beautiful, young. Like Beatrice Oliver. Like Mona No Name. The two recent disappearances hadn't been archived to the microfiche yet. But in a few months, they would join the inauspicious club. Julia checked the datelines. None of the stories were from Athens, which was a relief for the obvious reason as well as because it meant that she hadn't missed something during her daily read of the Athens Clark Herald. Julia stacked the printouts together. The stories had gotten to her. She felt her pulse racing again. The room had turned stuffy. She fanned herself with the papers. They flipped back and forth, offering flashcards of grieving parents and school photos and candid shots taken during summer vacations. All those pretty girls, all missing or taken or being kept. Or maybe their bodies just hadn't been found. An index card fell out of the pages. This note was in her mother's handwriting, not an admonition for requesting such dark reading material, but a dated invoice from the library. 28 printouts at 5 cents each. Julia fished $2 bills and 2 quarters out of her purse. Annoyingly, her mother would go out of her way to make change. She left the money with the invoice on the table. Her gaze picked out today's date, March 4th. Her grandmother's birthday was coming up. Again, Julia dug around in her purse. She found the card she'd bought before Grandma had remarked that Julia looked like she couldn't lose the last 5 pounds of her freshman 15. "She's calling you fat," Sweet Pea had said helpfully. Julia tapped the sealed envelope on the table. She had written some nice things inside the birthday card. Nice things that she no longer felt. Could she steam open the envelope and change the sentiment? In the end, Julia left the card on the table. Maybe this was what taking the high road felt like, but it sure sucked that no one else would ever know about it. She went into her bedroom, which was on the first floor because her father's upstairs office was too messy to move when Sweet Pea had come along. She stood in the doorway, feeling like a stranger, even though nothing had changed. The walls were still lilac. Her rock posters were still there. Indigo Girls, R.E.M., Billy Idol on the ceiling so that he was the last thing she looked at when she went to bed at night. Polaroids of high school friends were still stuck in the mirror frame over her dresser. Mr. Biggles was still on the bed. Julia picked up the decrepit stuffed dog and kissed his head, saying her billionth, silent apology for accidentally throwing him away the day she packed for college. Thank God her father had saved him. She smoothed back what was left of Mr. Biggles' mangy, patchy fur. The poor thing had suffered his share of slings and arrows. Julia had slept on him so much that he was almost one-dimensional. Sweet Pea had trimmed off his hair after a not-so-accidental Kool-Aid spill. Pepper had singed his nose with a curling iron, and Julia had tried to pretend it was funny when, actually, she was dying inside. Mr. Biggles was gently returned to his rightful place. Julia used the sleeve of her sweater to wipe some dust off the ugly blue lava lamp that she knew her mother despised, which is why Julia had left it here. The orange cat jumped on her bed. Julia ran her hand along his back, then realized that this was a second orange cat. His right leg was shaved where an IV had been inserted. His purr sounded like the vibrating teeth of a comb. Julia found the yellow scarf in her purse and climbed the stairs to Pepper's bedroom. As usual, the place looked like a bomb had gone off inside. Clothes covered the floor. Books were splayed, page down. A sin, their mother said. The walls were painted dark gray. The curtains were almost black. That the room felt more like a cave was completely by design. That their mother was infuriated by the effect was also by design. Julia put her hand to her neck. She had borrowed Pepper's gold locket months ago, but her sister had not noticed that it was missing until last Friday. There had been a heated fight where Julia had claimed she hadn't taken it. Then another heated fight when Pepper had realized that Julia was actually wearing the locket and had tucked said locket underneath her shirt to hide it. Instead of giving it back, Julia had stormed out of the house and slammed the door. "You stole my straw hat!" she had yelled over her shoulder, as if the locket theft was a tit-for-tat. Why had she been so childish? And why couldn't she just give the locket back now? There was Pepper's makeup vanity spilling over with trinkets that she had worn once, if that, then discarded. Silver and black bangles. A large black bow that actually belonged to Julia. Several t-shirts ripped flashdance style at the neck. Rainbow-colored leggings. Black tights. More eyeshadow and powders and blushes than Julia would ever know what to do with. Not that her sister needed makeup. If Julia was beautiful, Pepper was voluptuous. Far more preferable to Julia's thinking. Her middle sister was curvy and, now that she was getting older, sensuous in a way that made their father's friends say really stupid things around her. It wasn't just how Pepper looked. There was something about her attitude that drew people in. She always said what was on her mind. She did whatever she wanted. She didn't worry about what other people thought. She was certainly more experienced than Julia. She'd tried pot in the sixth grade. At a party last week, she'd snorted coke on a dare, which was terrifying, if not slightly impressive. The gold locket had been a gift from a boy who had gone all the way with Pepper in the back of his father's Chevy. At least, that's what Pepper had said. And why would she lie about something like that? Julia tucked the locket back under her collar. She slid some of the black and silver bangles over her wrist, because she had bought hers at the same time, and there was no telling whose were which. She grabbed the black bow. She left the yellow scarf on the bed, hoping her sister would see it amongst the discarded clothes. She was turning to leave the room when she heard a low moan. Julia felt her eyebrows furrow at the familiar noise. Had the poor old lab gotten stuck in a corner and forgotten how to get out? Was one of the cats about to hork up a hairball? The moan came again, low and drawn out, kind of like the satisfied sound a person makes when they manage to fully stretch themselves out. Julia stepped into the hallway. She noticed that her parents' bedroom door was closed. A sliver of light showed under the jamb. She heard the moan again, and she ran down the stairs before she heard it a fourth time and had to pour acid into her ears to cleanse herself of the memory. "Yuck," she mumbled, jerking her bike away from the front porch. "Yuck, yuck, yuck." The entire ride back to campus was filled with thoughts of anything but her parents having sex. The Iran-Contra hearings, which Julia had stayed home from school to watch with her father. The first dog she had, Jim Dandy, a golden retriever with a permanent limp because her father said, "Some jackass assumed a dog could understand physics and let him ride untethered in the back of a pickup truck." Sweet Pea's 13th birthday party last year. How excited they all were that she was finally a teenager. Except for her mother, who drank some of her father's beer and turned maudlin. the way Grandpa Ernie used to pull out his guitar after Sunday dinner, and they would all dance to whatever song he was playing, even if no one recognized the tune. By the time Julia got back to campus, it was exactly noon. She chained up her bike in front of the Tate Student Center and ran to her Spencer class. Professor Edwards was already lecturing at his podium, and he met Julia's harried entrance with a hard stare. "I'm sorry," she apologized as she made a beeline for her desk in the back. "I forgot my paper and had to go back to my dorm." She started to sit down, but he stopped her. "Bring it here." He had his hand out, his fingers flexed back and forth, indicating she should move, and he was not kidding around. Julia made the 1,000-mile journey back to Professor Edwards. She put her 12-page paper in his hand. Blots of whiteout scabbed the typewritten essay. She started to turn back around, but he said, "Stay here. This won't take long." She stood in front of his podium while he read her work. She shifted back and forth from foot to foot. She wrung together her hands. She didn't look at any of the sniggling classmates behind her. Professor Edwards, in turn, did not look at Julia. He had his head down. He flicked the pages with a sharp jerk of his wrist. Sometimes he nodded. More often, he shook his head. Edwards was younger than most of her teachers, probably in his mid-30s, but there was a tiny bald spot on top of his head that the girls talked about. Not because it made him less attractive. It must be acknowledged that Professor Edwards was very attractive. But because they always knew they could use it as a weapon if he ever tried anything with them. Because Professor Edwards had a reputation for trying things. It was one of those pieces of advice that got passed down through the classes. "Don't walk under the arch or you won't graduate. SAE stands for Sexual Assault Expected. Don't find yourself alone with Professor Edwards unless you want him to make stray remarks about how pretty you are, what a great ass you have, how your breasts are perfect, or how close his apartment is to campus." "What's the order of monks who shave their heads in a circle?" Nancy Griggs had asked when they heard the advice from a graduating senior. "Franciscan?" Julia had guessed, thinking it was something her mother would know, but that if she told her mother, her father would probably show up at her Spencer class with a shotgun. "Right," Nancy had said. "When he makes a pass at you, ask him if he's a Franciscan monk because of the bald spot on his head." When, not if. All of the girls assumed that Professor Edwards had a thing for Julia. The truth was that he'd never made a pass at her, but the rest of the truth was that he didn't have to say anything about her ass or her breasts because his eyes did all of the commenting. The real tragedy, other than that he got away with it, was that Edwards was actually a great teacher. Julia had coasted through high school on her writing. Edwards challenged her to put more effort into her work. He spotted her bullshit from miles away. He rewrote her sentences, explaining the rhetorical difference. He made her want to be better. And, at the same time, he made her extremely uncomfortable. Edwards finally looked up from her essay. "I like where you're going with this, but you know it needs work."
"Yes, sir."
He held her gaze. Her paper was still on the podium, one of his big hands holding it down in case she tried to take it. Julia gripped together her hands. Her face was flush. She was sweating. She hated any kind of attention. And the worst part was that she sensed that Professor Edwards understood this and was torturing her for it just because he could. "All right." He clicked his pen and started marking up the pages with quick strokes that cut into the pulp of the paper. "Don't need this," he slashed an X through two paragraphs she had spent hours on. "And this," he circled another paragraph, then drew an arrow up to the top of the page, move it here, then move this here. And actually, this paragraph on the back should move up to the beginning, right around here. And this is redundant. This too. This I like, but just barely. By the time he was finished, both Julia and her paper were reminiscent of an Escher clock spiraling into despair. "Understand?" Edwards asked. "Yes, sir." She understood that she was never to be late for another class ever again. Julia took the paper. He held on to it a second longer than necessary, so when she finally wrested it from his grip, the pages fluttered. She pretended to thumb through his notes as she walked back to her desk. She could feel Edwards watching her every move, and he even gave a weird grunt when she sat down at her desk, like he was mimicking the opening of an Al Green song. 1:20 p.m. The Tate Student Center, University of Georgia, Athens. Julia sat across the table from Veronica Voorhees, who was supposed to be sharing her salad but had already eaten over half of it. Julia didn't care. Her stomach was upset from the run-in with Professor Edwards. Not the one at the beginning of the class, but the one after class was over. Julia had been the last to leave the room. Suddenly, Edwards was right behind her, so close that she could feel his hot breath on her neck when he whispered, "Extra credit if I see you at my lecture tonight." "Oh," she said, momentarily stunned by the closeness. "Okay." "South campus. We could get coffee afterward, maybe talk about your paper some more."
Sure.
She had stuttered like an idiot. And then she'd felt his palm smooth the curve of her ass the same admiring way that she'd seen men at livestock auctions run their hand over an animal's flank. Julia was two floors down the stairs before she started to brim with should-haves. She should have slapped away his hand. She should have asked him what the hell he was doing. She should have told him to leave her alone, that he was disgusting, that he was cruel, that he was a really good teacher, so why the hell did he have to make everything gross by being such a creep? "What are you so pensive about?" Veronica asked. Salad fell out of her mouth. She reminded Julia of how Mona No Name ate the first day she showed up at the shelter. She had shoveled in so much food that she started to choke. Mona. Julia had been so wrapped up in her petty problems with Professor Edwards that she had forgotten all about the missing homeless girl. Was Mona really missing? Had a man really snatched her off the street and dragged her into his van? Had that same van pulled to a stop behind Beatrice Oliver 5 weeks ago? Whoever took either or both women knew what he was doing. He wasn't a boogeyman or a cartoon wolf. He was a shark with razor-sharp teeth who snatched helpless women from the surface and dragged them down to a dark place where he could devour them. "Julia!" Veronica knocked on the table for attention. "What's going on with you, kid?"
"Just tired."
Julia took a bite of grilled cheese sandwich to give her mouth something to do. She tried to banish the shark images from her mind by letting her thoughts return to Professor Edwards. She could report him. But whoever took her complaint would give Edwards a chance to respond. Julia had no doubt he would have a good response. She ticked all of the boxes quickly. "She's mad because I gave her a bad grade on her paper. This is payback because she threw herself at me and I said no. She's crazy. She's a bitch. She's a liar. She's been in trouble before." That last bit was actually true. Julia had been detained by the campus police last year. Some of the graduating seniors at the Red and Black had dared Julia to do something more than write a damning op-ed about the agricultural college's foray into genetically modified organisms. She hadn't realized that she was the only person not on speed until after they'd all broken into the lab and destroyed some equipment.
"Their pupils are bigger than my dick," the campus cop had told his partner.
Julia had never seen a real penis before, but she had no doubt that he was correct. In the cold light of the cop's flashlight, her fellow criminals were obviously stoned out of their minds.
"Hey, beautiful."
Ezekiel Mann stood behind Julia's chair. His clammy hands rubbed her shoulders.
"Where did you go?"
Julia hadn't gone anywhere, but she said, "Sorry."
"No problem."
His fingers dug into her skin.
"You got time for that game of pool?"
Julia was standing up before he finished the sentence. She had been manhandled enough for the day.
"Ladies first."
He placed a cue stick in her hand. Julia took the stick because people were watching and she didn't want to seem rude. She was really good at pool. Her grandmother had taught her. But she purposefully missed even the easiest shots so that Ezekiel wouldn't be embarrassed. The only saving grace was David Conford, sitting on one of the tweedy, overstuffed couches, who called the game like he was Howard Cosell.
"Julia Carroll, a young kid with a glint in her eye, leans across the table. Will she go for the 6 or the 10?
David stopped to drink from his bottle of Coke. He dropped out of character.
"You know, Julia, you're really bad at this."
Ezekiel said,
"She's pretty. She doesn't need to be good at anything."
Julia changed her angle and banked the 6 and 10 balls into the corner pocket.
"Down goes Frazier!"
David clapped his hands together.
"The comeback kid stuns the crowd."
To David's further delight, Julia sank the last 4 balls, then put the 8 in the side pocket while Ezekiel stood slack-jawed, his cue stick in front of him like a scaled-down petard. Julia sat by David on the arm of the couch.
"That was fun."
Ezekiel jammed his stick into the rack and stomped away. David laughed good-naturedly at his departing friend. He told Julia,
"Hey, Fast Eddie, give me a heads up next time so I can place a smacker on the game."
She laughed because David was one of those boys who was effortlessly funny. He said,
"I hear Michael Stipe is going to be at the Manhattan tonight."
Right. There were daily rumors that the lead singer of REM was going to be in this bar or the next one tonight or this weekend, or maybe he was already there.
"I thought he was on tour."
"Just calls him like I sees him, sweetheart."
David got up from the couch.
"Maybe I'll see you there?"
"Maybe,"
Julia said, but just to be nice. The student center was clearing out. Julia grabbed her purse and her book bag. Instead of getting on her bike, she headed toward the red and black offices a few buildings away. She felt buoyed by the pool game. She had let herself win at something. And she wanted to take advantage of the slight boost to her ego and present her pitch for the Beatrice Oliver story. The 28 printouts her mother left on the kitchen table had brought the focus of Julia's pitch to a fine point. People always said they wanted hard news, but what they really wanted was to be scared. These girls were all so normal, so innocent, so familiar. They could have been your mother or your cousin or your girlfriend. A daughter vanishes from a movie theater. A sister disappears at the fairground. A beloved aunt drives off in her car and is never seen again. Julia knew what mattered in Beatrice's story, the same details that had haunted her all these weeks. A beautiful girl disappeared while getting ice cream for her ailing father. Julia smiled. She repeated the line to herself as she walked down the long hallway to the red and black offices. And then she coughed in the perpetual hazy film of smoke that drifted out of the open doorway. They were all supposed to be reporters, but no one was about to do a story on the dangers of secondhand smoke because their advisor would rather take early retirement than give up his Marlboro Reds. Mr. Hanna called the journalism room his bullpen, which seemed to Julia a glorified way of saying,
He wasn't going to clean the mounds of papers from his desk, from the corners, and especially from the loaded bookshelves that ran around the periphery of the room. Julia loved the mess. She loved the horrible smells, the nicotine and ink and that weird blue stuff that came out of the mimeograph machine. She loved the clacking of the telex and the whirr of the printer and the shush of spray mount and zwip of the paper cutter and the hum of the two Macintosh computers on the long table at the back of the room. She especially loved Mr. Hanna because he had worked at the New York Times, the Atlanta Constitution, and the LA Times, all before pissing off so many people that the only place left to spout off his big mouth was inside the halls of academia. "Tenure," he often told them, "is the last bastion of free speech." Despite his scraggly, unkempt appearance, Mr. Hanna had done pretty well by moving to Athens. UGA's Grady College of Journalism was nationally renowned, which was fantastic if you were a parent who didn't want to pay out-of-state tuition, and horrible if you were an aspiring journalism student who wanted to live somewhere other than the town in which you grew up. Mr. Hanna smiled when Julia walked into the room. "There's my pretty girl." Somehow, he made the word seem like a gesture of affection rather than a creepy come-on. "Where is my riveting piece on the coming privatization of the cafeteria's meal services?" Julia handed him her article. He scanned it while she stood there, the overhead light reflecting her typed words back onto the lenses of his eyeglasses. "It works," he said, which was the best any of them could ever hope for. "What else you got for me? I need some news."
"I was thinking," Julia began, even as she felt the opening line she had so deftly crafted just moments ago slip out of her brain and float into the ether. "A girl, a beautiful girl was, and..."
Mr. Hanna clapped together his hands. "And?"
"And..." Julia's skull was an empty, brainless Tupperware bowl. She was vibrating with anxiety. She felt like she was going to burst into tears.
"Julia?"
"Yes." She cleared her throat. Her tongue had turned into a bag of wet salt. She went to the facts, because the facts mattered. "There was a girl who disappeared. She lived, about 15 minutes from here."
"And?"
"Well, she's gone. Abducted. The detective on the case said..."
"Probably ran off with a boyfriend," someone interrupted.
Julia looked over Mr. Hanna's shoulder. Greg Giannakos, Lionel Vance, Budgie Green. Their heads stuck up above the production partition like prairie dogs. They all had cigarettes dangling from their mouths, and all were on their way to becoming as flabby and bleary-eyed as their mentor. The only difference was that they looked at her with a marked absence of Mr. Hanna's kindness.
"Ignore them, kid," Mr. Hanna coaxed. "Pitch me a story I can put on the front page."
"Okay," Julia said, like it was that easy to recapture her earlier certainty. What was the heart of the Beatrice Oliver story? What was the hook? Julia thought about the terror that had gripped her when she first read about the girl's abduction on the telex. The menace she had felt this morning when she walked down streets that were as familiar as her childhood home. The fear summoned by the article she'd read in her mother's kitchen. She had to distill for Mr. Hanna what really bothered her about the Beatrice Oliver abduction. It wasn't just that the girl was snatched off the street. It wasn't just that she was being kept. It was why she had been taken in the first place. She told Mr. Hanna,
"Rape."
"Rape?" He was obviously surprised. "What about it?"
"She was raped," Julia said, because why else would a man abduct a woman less than two blocks away from her family home? Why else would he keep her?
Are you talking about Jenny Loudermilk? Greg Giannakko stood up from his desk. He crossed his arms over his broad chest. No way you can squeeze more than a paragraph out of that.
Julia shrugged, but only because she had no idea who Jenny Loudermilk was.
Apparently, neither did Mr. Hanna. Fill me in. Sophomore, Greg said, though Mr. Hanna had directed his request to Julia. Good-looking blonde, wrong place, wrong time.
Lionel Vance took over.
I heard she was pretty sloppy, spent most of the night looking for the bottom of a PBR. Yeah, everybody knows sophomores are cheap drunks.
Greg was clearly annoyed at having a story stepped on. Anyway, the gal was pouring her way down Broad Street and some guy grabbed her, took her into an alley, and raped her.
Mr. Hanna patted his pockets for his cigarettes. Nobody wants to read about rape. Say assaulted or attacked or threatened if she wasn't hit.
He asked Julia.
That's the story you want to tell?
Well, I...
She won't talk to you, Lionel said. The victim, they never talk, so what's your story? Some girl gets drunk and goes off with the wrong guy? Like Greg said, that's barely a paragraph. I wouldn't even put it on the back page.
Mr. Hanna lit his cigarette. He asked Julia,
You agree? Disagree?
I think
it's an anomaly, Greg interrupted. If your story is that suddenly the world is filled with rapists, you're wrong. And a university campus is statistically one of the safest places to be.
Mr. Hanna blew out a stream of smoke.
Statistics, huh? Greg said, Look, Jules, don't let your emotions cloud your judgment. Yes, what happened to Jenny shouldn't have happened, but a reporter only reports the facts. And you won't get any facts here because the victim already scurried off home. The guy who did it certainly won't talk, and the cops won't discuss a case that's never going to be prosecuted.
Julia's fingernails dug into her palms. She thought about the stack of printouts in her purse. She wanted to throw them in Greg's smug face, but they would only prove his point. 28 women in a state with a population of almost 6.5 million was hardly a significant number. He seemed to read her mind.
Jenny Loudermilk was one girl out of approximately 15,000 female students. That's an outlier.
Julia tried. It doesn't always get reported.
Because half of them got drunk and changed their minds.
I meant reported in the newspaper. She remembered that the articles were about missing women, not women who had been raped, assaulted, attacked. Or reported to the police, or reported to anybody.
For good reason. Greg lit a cigarette. This is the story. That the campus is safer for women than it's ever been. That the world is safer for women than it's ever been. Is that right?
Mr. Hanna crossed his arms over his chest. He was grinning like a maniac.
Back that up, hotshot. Give me your statistical proof that the world is safer for women, other than because it looks great through your Wonderbread Viewmaster. I will.
Greg went to one of the Macintoshes at the back of the room. He turned on the machine and sat down.
We've got all the crime statistics from the last 10 years on a set of disks. I'm gonna die of old age by the time that thing boots up.
Mr. Hanna stood at the metal shelves behind his desk. He traced his finger along the spines of several books until he found what he was looking for.
The FBI is mandated by the United States Congress to collect all relevant crime data from a set number of police forces around the country at least once every year.
He plucked out several books.
1989 is the most current report I've got.
He handed one of the volumes to Julia.
Budgie, Mr. Hanna called to the only boy who hadn't joined the fray. We need a non-English major for our computations. Get thee to the chalkboard. Julia?
He gave Julia a nod. Population of the United States in 1989?
She cracked open the book and thumbed through the index. She found the page number, then the correct page, and read 252,153,092.
Half that, Budgie. Men don't count in this equation.
It's not half, Budgie said. Women are slightly less than 51% of the population.
L'chaim.
Mr. Hanna tapped his cigarette ash into a styrofoam cup.
But half whatever you get from your 51% because they don't collect data below the age of consent.
Julia thought she'd heard wrong. She looked down at the book in her lap and ran her finger down to the methodology. Forcible rape includes assaults or attempts to commit rape by force or threat of force. However, statutory rape, without force, and other sex offenses are excluded.
You should have that number a third time, Greg said. At least that many women have buyer's remorse.
Whoa there. Mr. Hanna held up his hand like a referee calling a foul.
No conjecture allowed. Let's stick to the data,
he instructed Julia.
So, in your story, you'll say, extrapolating from the FBI's uniform crime reports, blah, 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 right?
Julia nodded, but this had stopped being her story a while ago.
Mr. Hanna asked, number of reported assaults in 1989, Julia?
Oh, sorry. Julia looked for the correct column. Forcible rapes, 106,593.
106,593,
Mr. Hanna repeated, making sure Budgie got the number right.
That's probably pretty consistent across the last 5 years, but we'll need to verify that.
Julia stared at the board, boggled by the figure. The population of Athens-Clark County was less than 100,000. The statistic was greater than every single person in town. Man, woman, and child.
Come on, Budgie, work the chalk.
Mr. Hanna clapped his hands to get Budgie moving.
Round up, son, we don't have all day.
Julia checked the data a second time, certain she'd seen it wrong. There it was. 106,593. She stared at the numbers until they blurred. Over 100,000 women. And that was just the ones who were over the